outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Hey man, I think I have the look.
The look?
Yeah, the look.
What do you mean the look?
Sarah and I were walking the dogs the other day, and this car kind of cruises up next to us and then stops, rolls down the window, and I'm like, I wonder what's going on here. My first thought is, the guy wants directions, and the guy, I guess, kind of puts his hand on his armrest, and the guy's hand in his chin, and he's kind of, are you a movie star?
Oh.
I said, what? He said, are you a movie star? And I said, no. He said, because you look like one. I said, I'm not. I can assure you I'm not a movie star. Okay, he said, and he drives off.
You didn't walk up to the window and give him an autograph?
I was standing right next to him. He pulled up right next to me because we're in a parking lot. Walked through this parking lot. So, yeah, he's that close. And I looked at Sarah and I said, I wonder what that was about. And she goes, well, you are wearing the sunglasses and the baseball cap, which is the disguise of choice in the neighborhood. And this is a Target-rich environment for celebrity people. So I guess somebody's cruising around on a Sunday morning trying to find a celebrity of some kind.
Were you wearing the same shirt that you were wearing today?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm wearing a t-shirt. Wow, you're making fun of my shirt? Oh, okay. You think this looks like a famous shirt? What?
It does look like a famous shirt.
No, it's not.
If you were wearing that and dark sunglasses and a hat, I would have mistaken you for a famous person.
Hey, we've been playing a lot with grandkids this week. We had a little camp grandma and grandpa for a few days, which was awesome, and some little league with my grandson. And we were out one game on Saturday watching a playoff game. He's on the all-star teams. This is an all-star game. My granddaughter calls me from her home, and I'm sitting there with her mom, and I'm like, why is she calling me? So I answer the phone, and she's a little bit frantic. She's going, what are you talking about? He's going, I said, sweetheart, what's happening? She said, there's some strange men in our yard with the floaty thing. And I'm like, what? Okay, so I got her to her mom, and the story is somebody got the wrong address. And this is July 3rd. I guess they've got some kind of, you know, Independence Day party going on. And so they bring this huge, like, three-story bouncy house into the backyard, blow it up and leave.
Oh, in her yard.
In my daughter's backyard. And it's just the two girls are home. They're teenagers. They're home alone. But they didn't go outside. They were scared. There were strange men in their backyard first. And they blew up this huge bouncy house thing. And then it's like, Mom, what's going on? And so we go, well, it's a problem. So we'll fix it when we get home. She said, just leave it there. They obviously delivered the wrong house. And so the kids went out and had a little fun with it.
Absolutely.
At least one of them did. Of course, I would have. Eventually, a half hour later, they came back and got it. Julie said it was intended for one of their neighbor's houses. And this is what I'm telling the story for. I think this is hilarious. This is how people work. So the woman who's supposed to get the bouncy house and doesn't have it by the time it was supposed to be delivered calls the company to say, I didn't get my bounce house. And the company says, oh, yes, you did. We delivered it at 10:30 or whatever it was. And she said, I'm actually standing in my backyard and there's no house here. The response is, look in the right-hand corner. Like, now, this is not a little bouncy house. This thing's three stories with a slide off the top into a pool at the bottom.
Oh, and my just gosh. Going,
I love that. When people, you actually tell people, I've had more than my share of relationships when people tell me, Wayne, you believe this. And I'll say, I actually don't believe what you just said. Yes, your book, He Loves Me, says, no, I don't believe it. Whatever you read in He Loves Me that seems to suggest I do is a mistake. Either I worded it poorly or you read it poorly. Either way, you telling me what I believe is not going to be helpful to an ongoing conversation.
Like trying to convince you that you've got a three-story bouncy house in your backyard.
Yeah, I'm going to convince you because we delivered it. It never once assumed we might have put it in the wrong backyard, which is kind of a big mistake. You know, you just kind of go into someone's yard and set up a bounce house and leave. Nobody signed for it. Nothing. That's weird. But anyway, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice, even though I'm not in Wyoming at the moment. I'm currently in Michigan, actually. My wife and I decided to road trip up to see some family in the Grand Rapids area. And it's been wonderful.
You road tripped out there?
Yes, we drove.
Oh, wow.
So it's about 17 hours.
Still getting along? Still married?
Yes, we are. Yes.
That's great. They're
doing very well, actually.
How long is that drive?
15 to 17 hours, depending on how many stops you make and how fast you drive.
Us going to Denver. Done that too many times already.
Yeah, it's been really good. We've been spending a lot of time with family, and then Jess has actually been giving me a hard time because I have quite a bit of community out here. And so I've been able to get to spend a lot of time with some amazing just men and families from the Grand Rapids greater area, and got to just enjoy some time with them and hear what's going on in their life. And it's been, man, just a refreshing, refreshing experience to my heart, just to be able to spend time with these guys and to hear what's going on in their worlds.
Oh, I may be in Grand Rapids soon. I've got a pandemic trip to make up for. The place I was scheduled to go when the pandemic hit and we couldn't travel was to go to Grand Rapids and hang out with some folks there.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I'll probably be going back. Yeah, I'm not sure the date yet. We're still working on dates. I'm kind of got more requests now than I've got weekends available in the fall, so we'll see what happens.
I was wondering if that was going to happen.
I'm trying to move some things around and see what works. But yeah, really excited, I guess, to get back. What kinds of things you guys talk about?
Several, but I'll give you a prime example of some of the conversations that we've been having. We were sitting in a pub in Grand Rapids downtown watching one of the games for the finals NBA tournament. I haven't really been following it, but some of the guys wanted to go and watch. And one of the guys pauses the game and poses the question, what did your parents do in their marriage that you did not want to take into your marriage? There's seven of us guys. All of us have been married from between 5 to 10 years. All of us have kids under the age of 5. And it launched into a 2-hour intense conversation of what we had seen our parents do and things that we really enjoyed and felt like we wanted to take into our marriage. And then some of the things that we just were like, wow, I do not want that to be a part of my culture that continues on to the next generation. For example, I actually brought up one of the things that you and I've talked about quite a bit, about not feeling like you're the victim of the other person's choices, and watching my family and how everybody was under the direction of my dad's choices. So whatever choice he made, that was final. There was no argument. There was no discussion. No matter how detrimental it might have been to somebody else, there was no conversation that took place. And that was really interesting for me.
So the dad's always right?
Yeah. Yes.
I got it.
So it was just really interesting to go into that conversation. And the guys really talked a lot about how to fight well. That was one of the biggest topics that came up, was how do you fight well in a way that allows you as a person not to be diminished, for you not to sacrifice your identity, but to be able to also be moving towards us versus me in the midst of an argument. And what does that look like in response to personality, in response to the type of relational background they have and how it was modeled for them in the past? And it was very intriguing. 3 of the 7 guys said almost the exact same thing in regards to, we want to learn how to fight well and how to honor our wives well in challenging conversations.
It's amazing they would even call that a fight.
Why do you say that?
The adventure of getting to us is not so much a fight. It's an exploration together. When Sarah and I are fighting, we just call a timeout. Let's back off. Because fighting, I just see fighting as a different thing. Fighting is, I've got my thing, you got your thing, and we're fighting each other. Having an argument, having a difference of opinion, that's one thing. I'm just saying, I'm going to learn to fight well. I'm going to learn not to fight. I'm going to learn to explore well with my wife. That's how I would term it. I get what they're saying, but
in a lot of regards, that's what they were going after. Because the tensions in your life, for example, with Jess and I, Jess would greatly prefer to be either very close to or in a large city. Me, I would rather be in the middle of nowhere, still with access to a town or a city, but have lots of space around me, have mountains close, have lots of space around me. I don't think that will ever change. So how do we navigate that tension, especially when it starts to cause conflict in the relationship? How do we hold that tension well in the greater view of us?
That's part of the adventure, isn't it? Because Sarah and I are living that same thing. Sarah would like to live in a big city, and we are. I would like to be in the middle of nowhere, and I'm not. But there's no doubt that God has us here. The things that have happened here, the people we've met, the opportunities that have happened. And we got here because I felt like a number of years ago, we needed to move. And I felt like God said, this is in Sarah's hands. It's between me and Sarah. You go wherever she wants to go. I never told her that because I didn't want her feeling the responsibility to, I would be her victim. I just was going to agree. Whenever she settled on where she wanted to go, I was going to agree with her. And that's moved us to Southern California, which is the opposite of anything I'd ever want to live in my entire life. And yet I'm not unhappy here or unfruitful here. It's just fine. And I hope someday we get back to a more rural area, but Sarah doesn't. Sarah loves having every conceivable shopping option within 5 miles of her home. She loves that. And since she does most of the shopping and the errands, oh my gosh, I'm not going to take that away from her.
So what would be the difference between fighting and the adventure and discovering us?
Fighting to me is always high tensions, high voices, and I just think it's the opposite of communication. So we always time out. When Sarah and I are ramping up, we're like, okay, this is not going to get us to light. So where can we back off enough? Takes the time to go, okay, how do I care enough about what you want and you care enough about what I want that we're not fighting, we're discovering. We're kind of considering options. We're figuring out inside our own hearts who's going to lay down their life here for the good of the other, because that's going to happen at some point in most decisions that we make. And the bigger thing is, where's God's leading in this? I have no doubt that God wants us to live here. So I may not like it, but my fight's not with Sarah about that. It's really with God. I'm not unhappy where I live. I'm glad I'm near my grandkids. So there's lots of benefits to being here. That's how I mean it's not a fight. We didn't fight a lot when we were younger because Sarah wouldn't fight. So Sarah just rolled over to whatever I wanted, which was unfortunate. So that was part of her discovery and growth. Now that she has much more upfront about who Sarah is and what makes her life full, and I want her life to be full, particularly when I travel a lot, it'd be really silly for me to, like, let's live in a rural area where Sarah's not happy and I'm gone half the time.
Yeah.
You know, I want Sarah to be near the people she wants to be near with, the shopping she wants to be near with, whatever, because I can live anywhere. I can make that work.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. I think it's a different process. I think fighting is it's a contest of wills. That's how I see fighting.
Okay.
And discovering is the collaboration of wills to find something redemptive.
Do you think that, for example, if the fighting is aimed at the same topic, fighting and discovery are aimed at the same topic, but it's a level, but it's more a matter of what the emotional level is? So what we had talked about in a previous podcast about being in that prefrontal cortex, like that thinking, loving mind versus the reactive animal fight or flight mode. Do you think that's the difference between discovery and fighting?
That could be one of them. Sure. I think fighting is just the other person is your opponent.
Ooh, okay.
And it's just terms. You know, people can say fighting and I don't mean she's my opponent. We're actually trying to work at something together. And I'm fine with that. For us, terminology, I wouldn't want to learn to fight well, except with God. I always joke about fighting with God. I love that story where the old man is asked by a young man, do you ever fight with God? And the old man says, yes, all the time. And the young man says, do you ever expect to win? And the old man says, no, I always hope to lose. That's the kind of fighting me and God do. I always hope to lose. And I, at times, I'm saying, God, oh, please, please, I don't want to go down this road. Like, kind of like those Gethsemane experiences.
Yeah,
I don't want to go this way. But if this is the way you want me to go, I'm going. So I hope to lose that. Anyway, we were going to talk about something else today. We're going to get into marriage and fighting and discovery and all that stuff. I've been listening to a podcast and I shot it over to Kyle to say, hey, listen to this. I just wanted to listen to a 3-minute quote. And he went and listened to the whole thing. So now he's ahead of me. The podcast is called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. Now, I was never much involved with Mars Hill, he's not in my world. It's a more of a Calvinist, reformed approach. Mark Driscoll out of Seattle area built this big mega church, started in 96, blew up in 2014, doesn't exist anymore. It's not even there. So Christianity Today has set themselves to do this podcast on what happened at Mars Hill. And the question they're asking is, who killed it? Was it Mark? Was it the people? Was it expectations? And you kind of get, I'm partway through the first one, and we'll include a link here if you want to go hear the podcast. It kind of seems like we're all, everybody is involved in how these things happen and how they go bad. What have you thought so far?
First, I have to give a shout out to Christianity Today because a lot of their stuff often I have a really hard time with. But this podcast series shows a level of reflection and humility that is really impressive to me. They're asking some really genuine, hard questions about why the celebrity pastor genre of church expression is failing. What is it about the culture that's setting up? I mean, my favorite question so far that they have posed is, why do we continue to elevate young charismatic leaders who have talent but are lacking in character? That don't have the character and the depth and the foundation to be able to navigate the seductive allures and challenges that come from being placed on a pedestal. And the fact that they're being put on a pedestal to begin with.
Yeah, and that's where the podcast reaches out beyond Mars Hill, because they're talking about a number. Let me just play you a 3-minute clip. This is the clip I want Kyle to listen to, and then we'll come back on the other side of it and talk about it.
Mars Hill and Mark had a deep impact on me and the ministry that I helped lead. So like so many in this story, the fall of Mars Hill broke my heart. The sad truth is, I'm sure there are plenty of other names that come to mind when this topic comes up. Bill Hybels, Perry Noble, Tullian Chavichian, Ravi Zacharias, Ted Haggard, Carl Lentz, James McDonald. And those are celebrity names, but this is far from just a celebrity problem. I know of at least a dozen more. Pastors of small to mid-sized churches who were removed from leadership. It seems like it's an epidemic. Here's Ed Stetzer again.
I have a little flyer that I keep from the year I spoke at a conference at Saddleback. There's 7 of us speaking at their big global conference that year. And Mark was one of the 7. And I was one of the 7. And Rick Warren was one of the 7. But if you take the way the flyer is printed out, it actually has Rick Warren on the left side and I'm on the right side. And in the middle, there were 5 other speakers. And of those 5 other speakers, 3 of them ended up leaving the ministry for some reason. Mark among, and I won't, no reason to list the other 2. This is about Mars Hill. But some came back. Matter of fact, 1 didn't. But, you know, and I could name, I mean, there were others who were at that conference, who spoke at that conference, who weren't on the main stage. And what I would say is there's a body count of young pastors whose ability rose them to prominence before their character was ready for it. You know, Mark was and is a remarkably gifted person. And in some ways, you know, Mark was the first internet age megachurch celebrity pastor. And leading, you know, number one podcast, number one sermon downloads, those kinds of things. And so what that did is it elevated Mark to the stratosphere so quickly. Whereas, you know, you'd think you might be a pastor of a megachurch. And I know some people just think the megachurch is bad in general, but I know a lot of godly megachurch pastors, and I know a lot of megachurch pastors who I'm like, oof, there are challenges that they're walking through and maybe bringing other people through. But typically, you know, if someone would start a church and, you know, they might take 20, 30 years of faithful ministry, but the internet just propelled things with such rapidity. And the internet only sees how you speak. I mean, that's all the internet is. It's all about verbal articulation. So it doesn't say what's your leadership structure. It doesn't have an accountability in the local church. It doesn't have how are we living life on life. And so I think what we've seen since Mars Hill is that there have been other who have been elevated very, very quickly, again, where they're elevated by their ability before their character was ready.
And that raises one more question about who killed Mars Hill. If this is so widespread, if it just keeps happening, if it's not just about Mars Hill or just about Mark, or for that matter, James McDonald or Perry Noble or Bill Hybels, isn't there a bigger cultural issue at work? If it just keeps happening, isn't there something broader to look at, like ourselves? When we ask why this happens, shouldn't we ask why we keep doing it? Why we seem to like charismatic figures whose character doesn't align with their gifts, giving them platforms and adulation.
That kind of gets to the point you were just making, Kyle, yeah, about their ability rose them to prominence before their character was ready for it. And then probably the hardest statement, there's a body count of young pastors, and he lists some of them, only some of them. There's so many more.
Yes.
Who spawned these, as he said, very gifted men. But how does he mean gifted? That's where I go back to. But gifted means to me they fit in that religious framework of the Sunday morning business model of having some charismatic, whether it's because he's got a soft gospel, whether he's just entertaining. It seemed like in Mark Driscoll's case, they're talking about he was very abusive, that there was this narcissistic abuse of people who didn't agree with him that just attracted people in droves. They wanted to be around that or beat up by it or what?
I did dive into a little bit of Mark Driscoll's stuff and actually had just started to get into some of Mars Hill's stuff when it all started falling apart. And I started listening to some of his podcasts. I was like, ooh, there was some major red flags of like, there is a tsunami of trouble that is on the horizon for this community of believers.
And for those who don't know, that Mars Hill, there was an investigation done about his abusive leadership practices, yep, berating people, staff members. They were pretty much concluding he needed to take a break, and they gave him a break for a while. And then Mark decides to resign rather than come back and deal with those issues. And then Mark's never been heard from again and eventually closes the church down. But it wasn't because of some moral failure in terms of sex, which is usually what gets the people in trouble, or yeah, money. It was simply an abusive style of leadership that went on for years and years and years, and nobody raised any red flags till very late in the game.
What they point out in one of the later episodes, when Mark was first starting the Mars Hill movement and what was taking place there, when something is first getting going and the Holy Spirit is putting something on somebody's heart of like, hey, I want you to bring this perspective that I've shown you in our relationship, other people need to hear it. And you start wanting to share that message and share that truth with people, and it starts to gain traction and people resonate with it, and it's fresh and it's engaging and it connects with people's hearts. I think that's where he started. That's genuinely where I feel like Mark Driscoll and a lot of these other big names started. But then as it goes along, then all of a sudden you've got the allure of power. You've got the impact of finances. You have the expectations of others. You have literally being worshipped as a god in a lot of those environments for years upon years. Yeah, that's going to distort who you are. That's going to distort your image. And now you've got a thing that you have to maintain instead of having the peace and the freedom to say, Lord, what's next? Is your spirit still here? Are you still even a part of this, Lord? Or is this more maintaining my ego and my charisma and my sense of self-worth than it is moving the gospel and moving the kingdom into new space?
You're more generous to the start of that thing, I think, than I am, because I'm not a Calvinist, first of all. So the Reformist agenda, it's really to plant a church that's engaging with a certain theological agenda that I don't sync with.
Yeah.
So is that really God leading all that? That's a bigger question than I think I want to answer here.
Yeah.
But I love, and you talk about the generosity of Christianity Today in doing this, they really step back and are saying, hey, it's not the whole thing's bad. God did some amazing things. People yeah. came to Christ through this. People ended in the community with other brothers and sisters. There's a lot of healthiness, which even I've shared that from the shepherding movement back in the 60s and 70s, which was charisma gone awry, that there's a lot of wonderful fruit that has happened in the people who were involved in that, even though the form they bought into was horrific and they saw it way too late. I love that they're asking the question, the little clip we showed, which is the last question we have to ask is, what is it about us?
Yes.
That elevates these kind of people beyond the level of their character? And it's not so much us, I don't think, as what is it about this religious modality, this business model of gathering people on Sunday mornings and taking offerings? And what does it take to make it work and to build a consumer base that's huge enough to do whatever needs to be done? That we don't step yeah. back and say, the qualities it takes to do that are not the same as the character traits essential to the kingdom of God.
That was one of the biggest question marks that I had in this. It revolved around the idea of character. Because I agree with you, Wayne. I don't think that genuine Holy Spirit God-given character aligns with what it would take to be any mega church pastor, to be bluntly honest. I think they're different.
And I've had people tell me that. I had a pastor of a growing church invite me to do and he loves me seminar for his staff. And then he wanted to teach about it on Sunday morning, which I did. And at the end of the day, he's really struggling with, you know what? I love this. I think it's so true and so powerful. But do you realize I cannot pastor this church and share that? And I said, what do you mean? He said, if I were to believe the stuff and he loves me and live that way, and I desperately want to, but then I can't manipulate people the way I have to make this machine work.
Wow. Wow.
And that, which is incredibly insightful. I agree with him completely. And yet he decided that he would work the machine. That's where he goes, because that's his life, his income, his,
yeah.
There's so much that gets wired to that, ego as well, that gets wired to those expressions. I had another kid that I loved, and he was planning a church out in California and wanted my help. And I met with him, some of his vision and things that we shared. And some of what I shared with him was not easy for him to accept. And the yeah. congregation grew, and it was, you know, shining light in the denomination he was in. And then he left it one day. And I was, he wrote me a very pain. How dare you share this stuff? You tried to destroy this in me. And he would give me, this is, and then number of years. So obviously that relationship didn't continue. Number of years later, he hits me with a, I want to talk to you. And I sat down with him, and he and his wife had left. And the main reason they left, I didn't like the person I was becoming.
Wow.
That's what he said. I didn't like who I had to be. Which I admire that choice.
Yes,
there was no scandal,
absolutely.
No nothing. He just said, I notice people are laughing at my jokes when they're really not funny. I notice I'm a stage presence, not a friend. People don't know the real me. The first pastor I worked for, one of the things he said, one of the first week I was on staff is, I'm afraid that when you get to know me, you won't respect me.
Mm.
And I thought, really? What is it about character that gets lost in the Christian machine?
The second episode of this series actually goes into the last 70 years of history in different movements in the United States that have led to this culture, and talks about different movements in Southern California and in Canada, like all these different movements in different denominations, but that all have similar themes that lead to this charismatic, dynamic person that an entire movement is placed on the back of one person and their vision and their ability to cast that vision and their ability to propel this thing forward. I have to say that listening through the three episodes, I loved it and I loved the questions that were being asked, and yet my yuck meter was pegged so high, so high.
Yes, I hear you. Mine too.
Partially because, Wayne, I could have been that person. That was the thing that I was just really reflecting on, as I was like, Lord, I could have gone there. I love public speaking. I have a dynamic personality. I'm creative. And I love to create new opportunities and ways for people to engage in conversation with Christ. As I'm listening to, and as I've watched some of these people crumble, as I've helped other people go through it, I just am like, man, Lord, I was going there. I literally was going there. I had people offering me that invitation, and by God's grace, I didn't say yes. I could have just as easily gotten sucked into something like that.
I was trying to build a church like that. So it's not that I don't understand, not with the Calvinistic tendencies, but
yeah,
something that people would be drawn to, that would be, but every time we were making decisions, we were making relational decisions in an environment that required institutional decisions.
Mm.
And so at times, looking back now, I realized I was working against my own success in terms of what that machine needs to be.
Yeah.
And what I couldn't do, because I was constrained by things I felt Jesus was putting on my heart. And so we just couldn't, you know, batten down the hatches and teach the leadership stuff and drag people into a format and sell a framework. I wanted people to follow Jesus. I didn't want people following Wayne or Wayne's view of Jesus.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, a couple of weeks ago, I ran across this article in Inc. magazine. That's INC, Inc. It's business stuff. This has nothing to do with Christianity or religion or anything. But I was captured by the title. How can you be sure someone has what it takes to lead people? And so I looked it over, and it's drawn. The article is built off of a book by Dr. Marcus Warner and Dr. Jim Wilder. The book is Rare Leadership in the Workplace, Four Uncommon Habits That Improve Focus, Engagement, and Productivity. Having interviewed and coached hundreds of leaders, I have seen the best and worst of leaders. The worst, well, they're easier to spot because their immaturity stands out, affecting their teams and organizations. Quite truthfully, The lack of maturity in most leadership settings is becoming increasingly obvious. Most organizations are so results-driven and short-term focused, they don't put enough emphasis on the actual emotional maturity of the people they hire and promote that will benefit them long-term. Mm. Most leaders have been trained to solve problems and get work done. They have not been trained in relational skills and emotional regulation. So I know we don't have much time left, but just there's four things. I say these four uncommon habits, and I was just taken by them. I'm going, wow, this would change the world. And I know they're coming at it from a purely secularistic viewpoint, but the first one was remain relational. No matter how big the problem is, there's always a way to handle it in a way that values the relationships and not just the solution. Now, every conflict, religious, church conflict I've ever been in, it was never about the people. It was always about an objective, an agenda someone had to get done, and they didn't care how they had to treat people to get there. And that's a lot of what they're saying about the Mark Driscoll story. I don't know it personally. I've never talked to anyone that's been on his staff. The only reason I knew about Mark Driscoll is he'd done a rant on The Shack when it had first come out, and someone sent us the video link. And I heard him rant about The Shack, and he was mocking it. And I didn't know that was his shtick.
Yeah.
I really didn't. But I thought, man, what a turnoff. Why are people following this guy? It's the same thing like seeing Jim and Tammy Baker on PTL in the old days. Why are people following this? This is just so warped and so unkingdom principled, so unkingdom minded. So he says, good leadership people remain relational. It's not just solving problems. It's how you treat people on the way to that. The second one was act like yourself. To act like yourself, they say, means acting like an adult. This means having the strength to stand up for yourself, but also those under your care. In order to act like yourself, you need to know who you are. Mm. Back to identity. We could do a whole podcast. Hope we do someday on identity.
Oh, man. Yeah. A series.
Yeah. We start out with an identity that we've basically taken on as a means of coping mechanisms and ways we had to be to get people to like us. And we think we know who we are and we don't have a clue.
Yeah.
Until Jesus begins to set us free inside his love. And now we're not having to get that love from other people. So security is not based in how you treat me, what you think of me. It's based on him and what he's doing in my life. That leads to a different way of living in the world. I've seen people who thought they were introverts become extroverts. People who thought they were extroverts because it was compensating for something found out, no, they're much more introverted, much more deep thinking, much more enjoy a few deep relationships than having a whole bunch of people around them to beef up an insecurity about who they are because they've got a crowd to follow them. And I love this stuff. I think this is what, when you talk about where Christianity kind of went off the rails,
yeah,
it's when we started training 20-year-olds to be pastors instead of fighting 40-year-olds who already demonstrated the character in their families and lives, which is where Paul points Timothy and Titus.
Yeah.
It's almost all, you've got to have some ability. You've got to be able to teach something. You've got to be able to share in a way that people can hear and understand. But the overwhelming important thing is the quality of your character and how you treat people. And that's just sorely lacking. I remember one time watching one of those Christian network TV things back in the 80s. And some guy didn't know the camera. I won't even say who he was, but he didn't know the camera was still on. He thought they'd taken a break to something. And he just reamed out a staff member for making some simple little mistake. And I just went, whoa. That's more important to know that than anything else.
Yes.
When the camera comes back on, all smiles and how you doing?
Oh, absolutely.
That's when I came up with the article I wanted to write for Leadership Journal, which is, I'm not really a preacher. I just play one on TV. they wouldn't do it. Yeah, remain relational, act like yourself, and then the third is return to joy. When do you find leaders that live in joy? It says the authors say most leaders are running on two types of fuel, the relational fuel of joy, which I love that. Why is joy a relational fuel or the non-relational fuel of fear?
Mm.
And religion is mostly about fear, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about that. That's why Jesus comes, talks about, I want my joy to be in you and your joy to be full. Find your way into joy. Then you know how to navigate even the most distressing circumstances in your life because you can lean not to the fear of what others are doing and what's it going to do to me and what am I going to lose? And then you go into panic mode instead of leaning into the joy of the Lord that's bigger than what's happening to me right now. And in that space, I can make better decisions. Fear is the killer. We've got to lean out of fear and lean into joy. And in joy, that's what can motivate the life that we share.
Yeah.
And the last one, endure hardship well. The great leaders of history are often held in high regard specifically because of their ability to navigate the hard times they faced. Mm. And so much of our, even our warped view of religious leaders is find somebody who's never struggled. Yeah. Just looks like they have all the answers. Everything goes in place. One of the very first podcasts we did was one with Tom Moen, who said, one of the things every man of God needs in their life is a failure so great, they'll never be arrogant again. And I love that.
Ooh, yeah.
Until you've failed, until you struggle, until you've been pressed in the crucible of a horrible circumstance and didn't win by the strength of your right arm and your ability to lie and hire lawyers and push for your way and do all that, until you learn how to listen to God in the midst of trial and how to have a maturity of heart that isn't impacted by the trial, rather the trial is impacted by the character.
Back to the conversation that we were having about young leaders and putting them in places where they don't have the character, they don't have the life experience yet. Yeah, they may have the passion. They may have the eloquent ability to be able to captivate people's attention. Mark Driscoll, for example, one of the invitations that he offered was he was a bull in a china shop in a PC world. When everybody in the Christian community was all about their reputation and being nice and being, he was willing to just blast in there, say what he was thinking, be open, honest, transparent, blow the boxes out of the water was his initial brand. Was let's blow the Christianese boxes out of the water and let's get down to the real conversations. And people were drawn into that. But then it became really dark and really abusive and very narcissistic very fast.
Because it was rude. It was a rude way of doing it. It wasn't.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it wasn't like opening doors to truth and conversation. And we've seen our whole society go that way now, right? It wasn't just Mark Driscoll. He tapped into something like,
no,
you're talking about the Coming in the Future podcasts of, man, how dark this world can actually be.
Yeah.
When you lean into that space and you're just going to blow the boxes off everybody. And we always get to this point about character and religious leaders. It's always about some moral failure, some abuse of power, some whatever. We can't see arrogance when it's in the pulpit. Mm. We can't see anger when it's in the pulpit. We can't see how people who exacerbate fear to control and manipulate people, those aren't character issues. We don't see that. It's got to wait till somebody has sex with the secretary or beats up on somebody or takes money and runs off as some extravagant lifestyle. When I read the Psalms, what always stands out to me is arrogance is what destroys the heart of a man. It's what God abhors. God loves humility. God loves people who live in a different space, so that they're not promoting fear in people and they're not having to bully people. And so many of our religious leaders are either, and Mark Driscoll would say, some are just so soft, they're just not willing to offend anybody over anything. And the others are absolute bullies. Yeah. And most of the really famous ones are just bullies on screen and off screen. And it's disfigured who God is, and it's disfigured why people have turned away from Jesus as the possibility of the life they need, because they see God configured as this angry deity that's always demanding, always pushing, and never giving truth in a way that people can access and be transformed.
When you were preparing to be a pastor, you were moving into your pastoral role. Had you experienced a failure so deep, so intense, that there was no way for you to be arrogant again?
Worst sermon I ever taught in my mid-30s was a sermon on humility.
Really?
I did. It was. I remember I was halfway through it going, I don't even know what I'm talking about. It was in the text. It had to be covered. And I'm trying to cover it like in all the religious ways of self-deprecation and blah, blah, blah. But I could tell in the middle of the sermon, I had no idea what humility was. My ego was running wild. I knew it. I knew it when I was teaching it. I went home going, it's the worst sermon. I was embarrassed for weeks. No one ever criticized it. I never heard anybody say it was a bad sermon.
Did you ever circle back and say that to him?
No, my gosh, I was too unhumble to do that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, at that point, I'm just like, I don't know what that is. I don't know. Because it's the opposite of what I'm doing to thrive in this environment I'm in.
Yeah.
So we can talk about, like, I mean, I was joking about servant leadership, but it's just a term, right? Because a servant is not what most leaders are. That's an oxymoronic statement. in the way our culture works and the way our religious systems work. No, I never did. But I tell you, what I've treasured most about my life right now is the freedom not to bully my way into a fight. I mean, the one tool Jesus gave, he said, you've heard an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And I'm telling you not to resist evil. That's what Jesus says. Don't resist it. And I've been resisting evil my whole life. And I'm learning now to go, okay, the one tool he's given us, like if you're in a toxic relationship, you're in something like that, the tool he's given us is to shake the dust off your feet to go on.
Yeah.
It's withdrawal. It's not engagement with the arrogant, because that'll just make you arrogant. It is withdrawal from it and suffer the consequences, because, yeah, you didn't fight for your place.
Or your reputation.
Yeah, trust God to take care of that now.
Mm.
And that is a different way to live. Now I could talk about humility, I think, in a way that would make more sense because I've lived it. And no, I hadn't had a tragic failure until much later in life. But that changed me. It did. I don't feel like I know all the answers. I don't feel like I know better than you. I don't feel like if I'm saying to you, hey, I think you believe this and you tell me you don't, that I get to say, oh, but you do, you moron. I don't get to do that. I get to take people at face value. And yes, occasionally I'm disappointed and abused by people when you take them at face value.
Yeah.
But I'd rather live this way. And then you just, when you realize the relationship is so toxic, there's no fruit in it, you just graciously back away and go on to where those relationships are fruitful. And they're going to say all manner of evil against you. Let them. Jesus said you're blessed. When they exclude you, lie about you, insult you, you're blessed. And no, it doesn't feel blessed. But if you go down that road, you will be blessed. Because you'll learn the way to navigate a world with a better character than I've always got to be looking out for me.
Mm.
One of the best things I heard, Dallas Willard posted something online and somebody had attacked him and he hadn't responded, even though the person attacking him was just ridiculous. And somebody asked Dallas, why don't you respond? And he said, I'm learning the discipline of not always having to have the last word.
Mm.
I just love that. The way Jesus navigates life is so different from the way we humans do it and the way our religious institutions need it.
I'm looking at these megachurch pastors and the way they did it, some of my experiences being in pastoral internships, and I see them failing. I see them not going in a godly way. They're causing a lot of destruction. So Wayne, how do we live a Jesus way of bringing his kingdom into the world? How do we engage people with the kingdom in a Christ-like way, the way that Jesus did it? How do we do that in today's world?
I wish we had more time. Why don't we take that up next week?
I'd love to.
I'm looking forward to continuing this podcast and seeing what else they come up with.
Oh man, it's good, Wayne. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to talk to you more about it.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.